Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and today we will continue our analysis of the banking system in light of the fallout of Silicon Valley Bank, Credit Suisse, and so on. Joining me for this discussion are, again, Nicolas Dehon, who is our senior fellow at Bruegel, expert on banking and everything around it, and Sylvia Merler, who is non-resident fellow also here at Bruegel. Hi, Sylvia.
Hi, Giuseppe. Thank you for having me.
And thanks, Nicola, for joining from Washington, D.C. The collapses in rapid successions of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank in the United States and of Credit Suisse in Switzerland have reawakened the debates on banking policy in the European Union. Today, what I would like to do, as the last time we were really on the aftermath of those events, is a little bit of more like analysis after the dust must. I will ask to you if the dust actually has been settled or not on those issues, and to explore what are the main things that we should have on our radar, and a deeper focus on the European banks, especially, and the EU regulation of the sector. But first things first, as I was saying before, is the dust really settled, especially in the US? Maybe Nicolas, since you are in DC, you can bring us over there. And what is the mood?
Yeah, thanks. And thanks for having me again, Giuseppe. The crisis moment appears to be over, but that doesn't mean the crisis sequence is over. Let me explain. I think we had a crisis moment that was triggered by Silicon Valley Bank and also by the perception that there was this failure by the Federal Reserve in the US to prepare properly for the kind of risk that hit Silicon Valley Bank by their fault, which was principally interest rate risk. The fact that they had a maturity mismatch between their assets and liabilities, they had rentable deposits which they invested in long securities, and these securities were vulnerable to interest rate risk because they were long-dated government securities. So I think the moment of collective doubt around the weekend of 11-12 March, a month and so on ago, was really about that kind of exposure, that kind of risk. And the general feeling is that this particular phase is over. What is not over is, and of course, the authorities, as we discussed last time, have responded very powerfully, maybe too powerfully, with unlimited guarantee of deposits. And the perception is that they may do that for other banks. So that's stabilizing in the short term, even so it may have a perverse effect in the longer term, as we discussed. What has not disappeared is that we are still in a sequence of interest rate rises. The inflation monster has not been killed yet. We don't know. And so there might be other pockets of risk that or other territories of risk vulnerabilities that would be revealed by these rising interest rates. So a lot of people are focused on commercial real estate. I claim no particular expertise on that. But I think in the US and possibly elsewhere as well, we will see the sequence of interest rate rises create or uncover new vulnerabilities. Will that result in actual instability? That, of course, is a key question from the perspective of the financial markets. And I think at this point, there is no certainty about it. But I would be curious about Sylvia's take.
Yes, I very much agree with Nicola on the broad picture, to be honest. I think what we have seen with Silicon Valley Bank is something that was obviously driven by very peculiar characteristics of that bank. So in particular, the mismatch in duration between assets and liabilities at Silicon Valley Bank was especially pronounced. And or the composition of deposits that Silicon Valley Bank was holding was also very much skewed towards large deposits, uninsured deposits, corporate deposits. So something that really set that bank apart from your typical bank, both in terms of the structure of their balance sheet and the risk that they were exposed to. At the same time, however, I think that what was an extremely pronounced case shares some similarities with the broader banking sector in both the US and Europe, even though probably more relevant for the US at this particular point in time, which is, as Nicola was saying, the fact that interest rates are rising do create issue on banks' balance sheets that become visible in this instance. So the interest rate risk is something that other banks are likely to share with Silicon Valley, but not in the same order of magnitude, but it is a problem that is related to the dynamics of rate. It is more a problem in the US than in Europe because of the different accounting standard that prevail in the two jurisdictions, but it is a common issue. As Nicola was mentioning, real estate is also something that people are closely watching, and even, again, more so in the US than in Europe, but there may be exposures of European banks as well to that, even if less pronounced than US banks. And then I would add one thing, which is what we have seen in both the case of Silicon Valley Bank and Credit Suisse is something that I believe might, if we were to have another crisis, become again relevant, which is the speed at which events have unfolded. And we now have more clarity as to the speed of events at Credit Suisse, for example. So Credit Suisse published results on Monday where it was made known that the deposit outflows in about a month reached almost 100 billion. So it was very, very fast for a bank of that size. Silicon Valley Bank was even faster. It was 42 billion in one day. So, I mean, something that it's really impossible to stop once it starts. And yesterday, First Republic Bank published also their results, and they were also showing similar kind of outflows and a similar time frame. So what this tells us is that when they happen, banking crises can be very, very fast, and they can be faster than probably we are used to and faster than regulators are used to. So this, I think, may continue to present a challenge if there were to be problems. And loss of confidence.
Sylvia, you seem to say that the situation in Europe is much more calm. So do you believe that EU banks are safe?
Yes, I personally believe that the situation in Europe is very different than in the US, both in terms of exposures to risks, like, again, commercial real estate is probably the one that I would also point to in terms of things to watch. And in terms of accounting of those exposures to interest rate risks that in at least a significant portion of the US banking systems have been treated less strictly than they have in the European context.
And Nicola, you agree with that assessment?
I think it's not just a matter of accounting, it's also a matter of supervision. So Andrea Enria, in his testimony to the European Parliament recently, insisted on the fact that the European banking supervisors had been very focused in recent years on both interest rate risk and business model risk. And I think that's not just hindsight. I mean, it was present in the communication of European banking supervision, indeed, in the last few years. The bigger question to me, which remains, in my view, very much unresolved, is what happened at the Fed. Why is it that we had such a basic supervisory failure? We had kind of textbook case of interest rate risk exposure, asset liability mismatch at Silicon Valley Bank. This was apparently identified by the Fed, according to the testimony of Michael Barr and Martin Grunberg earlier this month. But the Fed didn't take action. And to me, that remains a bit inexplicable. So there's a report coming up next week, actually two reports, one from the Federal Reserve Board and one from the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, And those are the two respective institutions of Michael Barr and Martin Grünberg that I just mentioned. So maybe we will learn a bit more about what happened. But I think the extent and kind of basic nature of the supervisory failure at the Fed is the central new information that came up with Silicon Valley Bank. And it leads to a whole reassessment of where the risks may be. So the good news here, the silver lining, is that there is no indication of similar supervisory failure in the EU and especially in the Eurozone with the European banking supervision centered on the ECB. But still, I mean, there's a lot of trust lost with the Federal Reserve System, and that remains a bit of a puzzle.
Staying still in Europe, and what we wanted to do was to have a look at what's going on the EU side and the Commission and the regulatory aspects of this world situation. And on the 18th of April 2023, the European Commission has adopted a proposal to adjust and strengthen the EU's existing bank crisis management and deposit insurance framework, the so-called CMDI. There are a lot of acronyms, as we know, in the sector, with a focus on medium-sized and smaller banks. So what I understand is that the Commission had as objectives three main points. One, to preserve the financial stability and protecting taxpayer money. Secondly, shielding the real economy from the impact of bank failure, and then better protection of depositors. So why did the Commission publish this update to the CMDI now? And is the proposal fit for the stated objectives, in your opinion?
So why it was done now, I think it actually was, it is something that was in the pipeline. It's been in the pipeline for some time. Nicola can correct me on this, but I think it actually was delayed a little bit following what was happening in the US over the past month, and then eventually was published right after, basically, the situation eased in the US. So I don't really know whether the timing is indicative of anything, but it is worth being done already and was in the pipeline. I think when I look at the CMDI proposals, the two things that I believe are, at least in my view, and I'd love to see what Nicola thinks about this, are most relevant are two elements. One is this idea of sort of trying to fill a gap that was there, I think, when it comes to the smaller banks. So, and this is also something that I wanted to mention in the context of our previous discussion about differences between the US and Europe. So in Europe, banks are supervised by the ECB as soon as they go over the 30 billion in assets threshold. So the banks that are left to national supervisions are relatively smaller banks in terms of their size. In the US, the size that triggers federal supervision is much higher, and it was increased in we know that in 2018. So it is something that sets really the two jurisdictions apart, because the kind of supervisions to which smaller institutions in the US are subject to is a lot more lenient, or has been so far, and this probably explains part of the supervisory failure than it has been in Europe. But said, in Europe, there still remained some frictions when dealing with smaller banks, particularly in case of banking crisis in those smaller banks and the need to do something about it. That is something we have seen relatively recently in the context of smaller Italian banks, for example. So there was a gap between what you do in resolution and what you do in insolvency. And typically for smaller banks, the road that was chosen was insolvency, because those smaller banks would not qualify for resolution to be applied. So they wouldn't meet the sort of for interest, public interest, that would allow resolutions in the place of insolvency. Now, the thing with this insolvencies versus resolution debate is that under national insolvency, it turned out you could actually use a lot more easily public funds in resolution, in insolvency, that you could do under the resolution framework that is stated in the Banking Recovery and Resolution Directive in the EU. And so I think the CMDI proposal in part tries to sort of like plug this hole that was allowed for this very different treatment of public funds in insolvency and in resolution. And obviously the other big element is the depositor preference. So CMDI effectively, for those countries where there already was not such preference, introduces a depositor preference that brings all deposits, even deposits that are not covered by the deposit insurance guarantee, so above the 100,000 euro limit, to the same level of seniority. Whereas in some countries in the EU, before this proposal, assuming this proposal then goes through, there was a tiering of seniority within the category of depositors that I think, and I think that is by far the most significant element of the proposal.
Nicola, do you think that this proposal still makes sense after what happened with Silicon Valley Bank?
Yes. So all this is very convoluted because there's a lot of jargon, there are a lot of acronyms, it's difficult to understand, and the sequence itself and the relationship between the different elements of banking union, the crisis, which is in the Eurozone, of course, the crisis in the US with Silicon Valley Bank, all these different factors collide with each other in ways which are extremely confusing. So I hope we won't add to the conclusion with our comments, but it's difficult to disentangle. So a couple of things. One, this proposal was born from the failure of negotiations to complete the banking union a year ago, a bit less than a year ago, in June 2022, the Eurogroup acknowledged that they were not able to make a big step towards a more complete banking union, which is about European deposit insurance, and also, which is not sufficiently discussed, the regulatory treatment of sovereign exposure. So the problem of that, you know, banks of country X in the Eurozone tend to have a lot of bonds issued by country X on their balance sheet with a huge home bias. So we have these two issues, European deposit insurance, sovereign exposures, which are intensely political. To oversimplify, deposit insurance is contentious in the north, sovereign exposures is contentious, having a regulatory treatment to mitigate that home bias is contentious in the south, and so there was a complete deadlock. And so what the Eurogroup decided in June last year was, okay, we're not going to make progress anytime soon on these issues. It's just too difficult. So we tried to do something more limited, which is incremental improvements to the crisis management framework, and especially trying to make it easier for the deposit insurance systems, even so they stay at the national level, to help in the resolution of banking crisis, and especially in the resolution procedure, which was introduced in 2014 with the Bank Recovery and Resolution Directive, BRRD, as Sylvia mentioned. And the proposal was, you know, took some time to prepare. The European Commission just published it now. It's a complete coincidence. There is absolutely no causality that this publication comes at the time when everybody is discussing Silicon Valley Bank and Credit Suisse. And my view, to answer your question, Giuseppe, is that this coincidence doesn't impair the relevance of the proposal. So I don't think there's a need to discard or even change the proposal for crisis management and deposit insurance, CMDI, in the light of the experience of Silicon Valley Bank and Credit Suisse. But that creates confusion. And to add to the sense of confusion, there's probably not a lot of likelihood that the proposal can be adopted before the European Parliament election, which is coming up in a year's time in spring 2024. So in a way, in typical Commission fashion, the Commission is publishing the proposal because it got a mandate to do so. It also believes this proposal is useful. But the proposal is probably not going to be adopted despite the best efforts of Pascal Donohoe, the president of the Eurogroup, before the end of this parliamentary term. And that means we'll get into a new cycle in 24 with new commissioners, a new European Parliament, new priorities, a lot of water under the bridge, and probably we'll have a new discussion about a whole set of issues, including European deposit insurance and sovereign exposures because they haven't gone away at some point in 25. Does that mean the European Commission's proposal on CMDI is useless? No, I don't think so. I think it's useful because it brings the debate forward and it helps people think about it. And especially as Sylvia rightly said, probably the most important piece of the proposal is this concept of general depositor preference. So all the depositors are at the same level of priority in an insolvency, and they're all senior to other creditors, including senior unsecured creditors. And that sounds very technical, but actually it's very important for the bank's business models. It's very contentious politically, including in Germany and France. And I think it's a good proposal for a number of reasons that we can discuss further. So the thing is, it's a bit buried in the communication of the Commission. If you look at what they have published when together with the CMDI proposal, you really have to go kind of to the last page to understand that they have included this concept of general depositor preference. So that doesn't help public understanding. What also doesn't help public understanding in the bigger picture of completing the banking union is that the Commission still hasn't published anything on this critical issue of sovereign exposures. But with all that in mind, I think the proposal makes sense. It's a good contribution to the debate. Sadly, it's probably not going to be adopted as such, but it's a worthy effort.
Thank you. The obvious question that after you have been sketched this timeline of events and going further into the next couple of years after the European elections and so forth, is obviously, and you mentioned it yourself, is the elephant in the room question, which is about the banking union and about whether the banking union will ever be completed. And I know, Nicolas, that this is a darling for you and your research, and therefore, even though I would like to hear from Sylvia as well, I would like to kick off on that, as this is a big elephant in the room. And then, for sure, Sylvia, I'll give you the mic, and I would want to hear what you think about it.
Yeah, I'll be briefer on this because, in a way, I've already commented on it. So I think, you know, these problems are not going away. The Eurozone is fragile, not just the banking sector. The Eurozone in general is fragile as long as the banking union is not completed. And to complete the banking union, you need European deposit insurance and you need to address the problem of concentrated sovereign exposure. Some people would say you need a European safe asset, but that's probably putting the bar too high. And I think it's realistic to combine a regulatory treatment of sovereign exposures that would push for less concentrated exposures in one single country of the bank's sovereign portfolios and genuine European deposit insurance. And I think there's a deal to be made there, but it's very difficult. And so we're not going to see it unless there's a crisis, God forbid. In the meantime, we're not going to see it certainly before 25 and maybe in 25 with, you know, new teams in place at the EU level and in some of the member states perhaps as well. Maybe, and also with time having passed, because time can sometimes help solve issues, maybe there will be a fresh start of that discussion. But the idea that this discussion has failed and therefore let's move on to something else, I think that idea doesn't work because the problems are not going away. Sylvia?
Nicolas is the world expert on banking union, and I think he probably also needs to be credited for inventing the term, so... No, you're not? Okay, well...
So Bruegel got the term into the public debate, and I was involved in that. But this was at the suggestion of Martin Verwey at the European Commission, who had heard it from an academic in a conference, I quote. And Martin and I were never able to identify that academic. So here I'm making a public announcement. Whoever invented banking union, please identify yourself so that we can give proper credit. Sorry for interruption.
But we can definitely not credit you as the only father of the term, but one of the people that contributed to establish the idea.
So anyway, this was a very long and convoluted way to say I do agree 100% with what Nicolas said. What I would also point to is something that I said before. So what the recent episode in the US has shown is that if you do have a crisis of confidence, that crisis of confidence can be unstoppable and it can really unfold very, very quickly at the speed of light, one might say, if we look at the case of Silicon Valley Bank, but also if we look at the case of a bank like Credit Suisse, which is obviously completely different kind of in terms of size, in terms of business model, and in terms of deposit base. So this obviously heightens the importance of discussing about European deposit insurance. And I think this should be very, very clear at the moment. But I also think, as Nicola was saying, probably isn't enough right now to really push that discussion forward. So what the Commission did with the CMDI proposal that we just discussed is sort of like a small step, a step in the direction of mitigating that risk that we talked about on the deposit side, because the moment you do introduce same level of seniority across all deposits, in a way, you sort of like reduce the importance of the having that threshold, the 100,000 euro threshold of insured and uninsured deposits, because in a way, at least treating them at the same level of seniority, even though there obviously still are differences in terms of reimbursement and the speed at which they will be reimbursed or the amount that will reimburse. But the seniority at least is the same. And I think that goes in the direction of mitigating that risk of having very, very fast outflows in case there's a confidence crisis. But if you do have a confidence crisis, if that happens, then I think the only element that can really act as a credible backstop is to prevent that confidence from being lost. And to prevent that confidence from being lost, ultimately, I think you would need to have a common European deposit insurance scheme. There were, I think, two stumbling blocks so far in terms of getting there. One, as Nicola was saying, is sovereign exposures. On that side, there isn't there hasn't been much progress so far, and it is unclear to me what will push that progress. So I don't really see the discussion moving forward on sovereign exposures, at least at this time, unless something happens, which, as Nicola was saying, might have to be something bad. So it might have to be a sort of a, like a crisis-like or crisis-looking event. The other stumbling block was probably the legacy issues, or in particular non-performing loans on some euro area banks' balance sheet, particularly in countries like Italy, Spain, countries that have been most exposed to the global financial crisis, but also the euro crisis later. And I think on that side, instead, a lot of progress has been made in those banking systems. So that side of the story, I think we could consider resolved. The other part of the story, which is finding a balance, striking the trade-off between what is needed on the sovereign exposure side and concession on mutualization that needs to happen on the deposit side. I think we're unfortunately still far from seeing that.
Do you think that the EU should move to an unlimited deposit insurance?
It's an interesting question because, in a way, it has that in practice, but not in theory. If you look at the very severe crisis through which the EU went between 2007 and 2017, if that's the right periodization, you know, we had a lot of bank failures, but with two exceptions that I'm aware of, and leaving aside small cases of fraud, which are a different logic, there were depositors never lost money, except in Cyprus, which was a case of sovereign creditworthiness issue, which is a different category, as long as we have national deposit insurance, and also a handful of very small banks in Denmark. So we have a Danish exception, which is outside of the Eurozone, but other than that, we have de facto protection of uninsured depositors in the Eurozone. And that's different from the practice in the US, because the US until now had a constant flow or near constant flow of banks, generally also quite small, so a bit like in Denmark, where when they would fail, uninsured depositors would lose money. So that's the difference between theory and practice, right? I mean, in theory, the EU has limited deposit insurance and the US had limited deposit insurance. In practice, the US had demonstrated the limited character of the deposit insurance. The EU, with a limited exception of Denmark, had not. And now the US is coming back on it, not by changing the law, because they haven't done that, but by changing the expectations with the actions they took on Silicon Valley Bank. So that's a long way to say that I think it would be unwise for the EU, as for the US, to move to explicit unlimited deposit insurance. But in terms of the implicit guarantee, the EU was already there and the US is coming there too. So in a way, that's convergence of the US towards the EU rather than the other way around.
Silvia, do you want to add something to this? You would agree with this?
No, I would agree with this. Yeah, no, I don't think there's really not much to add on this. I also would point out, Nicola mentioned Cyprus. This is a very peculiar case where we also had a crisis that was triggered by an event that in some ways you might relate to the Credit Suisse situation. So where the perceived hierarchy of credits was disrupted up to the point that it was hinted that even covered deposits might be. So that obviously triggered a crisis and very severe outflows. But I also would think this is a very peculiar case. So other than that, we didn't really see depositors being bailed in Europe.
And to your question, Giuseppe, actually, if you think in terms of a linear scale of market discipline, which of course is an oversimplification, so the US took a step back on market discipline with unlimited insurance of depositors of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank in March. But even after that step back, they're much further than the Eurozone. Again, leaving aside the Danish case, the Eurozone practice has been in almost all cases that not only were all depositors reimbursed, but so were all senior creditors. And that's not the case in the US, and it was not the case on Silicon Valley Bank, as President Biden and others have emphasized in their rhetoric. So that's the complexity of the situation. Even with a step back in terms of market discipline, the US at this point still has more than the EU. And one of the aims of the CMDI proposal, which I think is good, and especially as Silvia mentioned, the general depositor preference, which means that not only are all deposits at the same level of priority, but they're all senior to other creditors, that signals the fact that we would move towards more market discipline and more ability to impose losses on senior creditors if the situation of the bank demands it, which I would view as a good thing, and convergence towards the US for that matter.
100% agree. And also I would mention on senior creditors, I mean, the episodes that we have seen, particularly with the smaller banks in the EU, was that indeed, there seemed to be an expectation that bank bondholders, many of, to be honest, were clients to which those bonds had probably been vastly mis-sold by the issuers. So obviously, there's a lot of, you know, like caveats to bring into this, and a lot of different things to discuss. But there seemed to be an expectation that bondholders were expecting the same type of senior as depositors. And I think both in resolution and in insolvency, that becomes very problematic, because it then, if you want to meet that expectation, it either leads to more public funds having to be deployed for the resolution of the crisis, or it is really difficult to meet that expectation. And so you risk triggering a crisis in a similar vein as we have seen in the US for the recent episodes. So I think that is, in the CMDI proposal, I think that is really important to clarify that point.
Thank you. And we could obviously discuss for much longer all this, but this is all the time we have for this episode. But as you have seen, we will come back to that story and have those regular updates on the banking regulation and the banking system. I would like to remind our listeners that, as usual, you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. including the piece by Nicola, which we were mentioning earlier on in this episode. So Sylvia, Nicola, thanks a lot for joining this conversation. And thanks to our listeners for following us. Until next time, bye-bye.
Thanks, Giuseppe.
Thank you.